Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Soviet Union come apart, and how much did U.S. foreign policy have to do with it? While the George H.W. Bush administration celebrated the breakup and the new American primacy that came with it, my guest would argue that the collapse had very little to do with us, although it would set the tone for both the aggressive American foreign policy that has followed for the past 23 years and for the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Serhiy Plokhiy is director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. His new book is called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. Serhiy, welcome to Think.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Christmas Day 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev resigns as the last president ever of the Soviet Union. Here in the U.S., President Bush celebrated this as a victory of American policy. On what grounds did he make that claim?
For a long period of time, the American administration was claiming that the Cold War was over. Actually, one of the dates for the end of the Cold War is December 1989, when Gorbachev and Bush met at Malta and agreed on set of measures that helped to remove Soviet troops from Eastern Europe. The question of the reunification of Germany was discussed, and so on and so forth. But as the head of the CIA in 1991, Robert Gates, wrote in his memoirs, the U.S. had a victory but never had a parade. And it looks like that in December, on the Christmas Day of 1991, in presidential administration, the voices that thought that there had to be a parade prevailed, and President Bush decided to use the resignation of Mikhail Gorbachev from the position of the head president of now defunct Soviet Union as an opportunity to declare American victory in the Cold War.
Publicly, the president had been saying throughout 1991 that he and his administration had only limited power to affect what happened within the Soviet Union and its republics. Did they actually believe themselves when they started taking credit for the breakup?
It's a good question, and there were two documents issued from the White House on the same day of December 25th, 1991. So the first one was a written statement related to the resignation of Gorbachev, where Gorbachev was credited for being instrumental in ending the Cold War together with the United States. So there was no word of victory. There was full credit to Gorbachev was given. And then a few hours later, there was this statement, TV statement to the nation, and there was a very different tone, despite the fact that some of the parts of the statement, written statement, and then oral statement were the same, but the emphasis were very different. And one of the explanations for why that happened was that President Bush was already in the middle of presidential campaign, his re-election bid, and he didn't do very well either in December of 91 or then later in January and February 92, when he actually developed the same kind of ideas in his State of the Union address.
One outcome of the claim that the United States had a lot to do with the breakup of the Soviet Union was that American people seemed to have accepted the idea that we had the ability to directly influence events abroad. Your sense is that this belief led pretty directly to a number of subsequent foreign interventions by the United States, not least of which was our war in Iraq.
Well, a lot of things really started in the year 1991. We look at this year as the end of the Soviet Union. Many people look at this year as the year of the end of the Cold War or American victory in the Cold War. But that was also the beginning of many things. So when you look at what happened then in Iraq, many people in the administration of George W. Bush believed that they were finishing the job that was started in 1991 with the first Gulf War. What I'm trying to argue in my book is that there was more than one beginning in 1991. There was also this belief in exactly what you said, that the United States are all-powerful and can do things in the world in the name of good things and ideals and in defense or promotion of democracy, that there was no other major power like it was the Soviet Union to basically check the U.S. influence or U.S. power. One thing that it's very important from my point of view to keep in mind, that looking at the end of the Cold War, we very often put together three different processes. One of them was the collapse of and end of communism. Another was the end of the Cold War. And then the third one was the disintegration of the Soviet Union. These things were related. This is not my original idea. The U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock, actually develops that in his own memoirs. But one thing is absolutely certain, that the disintegration of the Soviet Union was never American goal in the Cold War. And indeed, President Bush Senior and people on his staff are doing everything humanly possible, everything possible in terms of diplomacy, to keep the Soviet Union going as long as possible.
And part of the reason for that was that there were concerns about instability throughout the region if the Soviet Union did not exist, and there were questions of loose nukes in the region.
Exactly. The nightmarish scenario at that time was that there would be the so-called Yugoslavia with nukes. So imagine, for example, today's conflict between Russia and Ukraine, with not only Russia but also Ukraine being armed with nuclear arms. And that was the case back in 1991. Not only Ukraine but also Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Russia had nuclear arms, and this uncontrolled disintegration of the Soviet Union with republics armed with nuclear weapons, that was one of the reasons why Bush was very reluctant to help the Soviet Union into its grave. And the second reason was that the U.S. administration felt really very comfortable working with Mikhail Gorbachev. The Soviet Union in 1991 really acted on international arena as a junior partner of the United States. So the first Gulf War was fought on the basis of the resolution passed by the Security Council, and the Soviet Union voted in favor of that resolution. So the questions of Cuba and Soviet support to Cuba, the Soviet support to the Afghanistan government, pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan, all of these things were on the agenda, and President Bush and people around him believed that they would have much better chances solving these issues to the American satisfaction under Gorbachev. Not even Yeltsin. They for a number of reasons, distrusted Yeltsin.
Remind us of some of the most important ways that Gorbachev differed in terms of approach from his predecessors.
We have certainly the situation in which President Bush had a lot of respect for Gorbachev. He approached the relations between the Soviet Union and the United States very cautiously originally, but then developed that respect. The reality was, however, that by 1990 and 91, Gorbachev really lost control over what was going on in his own country. He was a very talented politician. One had to destroy the state over him. He was the president, and only after that he resigned. So there was a coup, but no one was able eventually to remove him from that position. But he wasn't really as great as a statesman, and from that point of view, a number of processes, economic and the development and the drive of republic toward independence, they were completely, he lost control over that process.
And Yeltsin was prepared to sort of move into the vacuum that was created, if not as leader of the Soviet Union, certainly as leader of a very powerful Russia.
Exactly. And Yeltsin was everything that Gorbachev wasn't, in a sense that he loved to talk to people, loved to be in the center of attention, and then also he had this sense of what people wanted at each particular moment and was prepared to seize that opportunity. Gorbachev really was never elected to any position. When President Yeltsin won presidential elections in the summer of 1991, which immediately put these two Soviet leaders in different positions. In terms of Yeltsin's goals, he immediately after the coup took place in August of 1991, the hardliners were trying to remove Gorbachev. Immediately after the coup, Yeltsin had this idea and vision that he would replace Gorbachev as the supreme leader of the Soviet Union. But then once that didn't happen, and that didn't happen for a number of reasons, the republics rebelled against that, Ukraine declared independence, whatever power the United States at that had, they were not interested also in Gorbachev living under those circumstances. So once that didn't happen, Yeltsin then opted for another option, and that option was strong, independent Russia that would leave the Soviet Union, but would leave it with all major resources, oil and gas revenue. That was the main source to fill the coffers of the Soviet Union. So Russia left the Soviet Union with all those resources, with the idea that once the situation would improve, once, as advisors to Yeltsin were saying, once Russia saves itself, the republics would come back, or they would be brought back, and the time frame, the time horizon that was given for that back in the fall of 1991 was approximately 20 years. So now we are in a situation of it's 23 years after the events, and certainly Russia tries to reassert its influence or its control over the post-Soviet space.
Why was Ukraine such a linchpin in 1991, in the sense that if Ukraine had stayed with the Soviet Union, it might not have broken up?
Exactly. And Mr. Yeltsin and President Bush had discussions about the importance of Ukraine in the summer of 91 and then in the fall of 91, and we have now access to wonderful transcripts of their telephone conversations through Bush Library. So Yeltsin's explanation to that was that if Ukraine doesn't sign union agreement, Russia would not sign either, because Russia didn't want to be outnumbered and outvoted by the Muslim republics in the Soviet Union, where it would be just Russia and Belarus and without Ukraine. So what that really means is that Ukraine used to be back in 1991, and it remains to be today the biggest, the largest Soviet or post-Soviet republic. So in terms of its human resources, in terms of its economic potential, also in terms of its geostrategic position.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is Serhii Plokhii. His new book is called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University, Serhii Plokhy. His new book is called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Serhii, before the break, you were explaining to us why Russia felt that without Ukraine, it was better to become an independent Russia than to try to preserve what was left of the Soviet Union.
Exactly. And the decision in that regard was made in October of 1991 when President Yeltsin and people around him decided that they would start the very radical economic reform on their own in Russia without waiting for other republics to agree on a joint plan. Again, until December of 1991, Yeltsin and his Russian advisors thought that this kind of economic independence of Russia could still work together with some kind of a loose association, maybe a confederation, where Russia would play important role, not just important role, but leading role. And that those hopes came to an end largely after the referendum that took place in Ukraine in December the 1st, 1991, where more than 90% of Ukrainians voted for independence of their country, for leaving the Soviet Union.
Has Russian ethnic identity in Ukraine grown in the years following the breakup of the Soviet Union?
Well, what we have the discussion of the issues of the Crimea that was invaded and seized by Russia earlier this year, and also the Donbas in eastern part of Ukraine where the war is going on now. These regions were discussed back in 1990 and 1991. And on the part of Russia, the plans were that if the majority of the population in those regions would not vote for Ukrainian independence, that probably would mean that political borders of Ukraine would change, or Ukraine would not be allowed to leave the Soviet Union. Actually, what happened back then was that 54% of those who voted in the Crimea voted in support of independence, and over 70% of those who voted in eastern Ukraine, in Donbas area, voted for Ukrainian independence as well, which closed that question for a while. But Crimea returned back to the headlines in the world media and also certainly in the regional media in 1994, so 3 years after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. There was a movement for either independence of the Crimea or its unification with Russia that was supported by the Russian authorities. It came to an end thanks to a deal that was negotiated with the American participation and in particular administration of President Clinton. According to that deal, Russia withdrew its support from this movement in the Crimea. The Ukrainian borders were recognized, and Ukraine turned in its nuclear arsenal to Russia. So that was the agreement that was signed by Russia, Ukraine, Great Britain, and the United States. And that was the agreement and the pledge to protect sovereignty of Ukraine that was basically violated earlier this year by Russia.
What makes Crimea such a particularly desirable piece of territory?
Certainly if you look at the map of the Black Sea and imagine that your military bases are in southern part of the Crimea, It's very clear that you really can control, whoever is in possession of those bases can control the entire Black Sea. The deal of 94 included that the Crimea would stay Ukrainian, but the military base in the city of Sevastopol would be under Russian jurisdiction. And certainly that was something that apparently Mr. Putin was not fully satisfied with. And the Crimean situation and the situation in eastern Ukraine should be understood in broader context. It's not just a land grab. It is a land grab, but there is more to that. Like it was the case in 91, Russia believes that any meaningful integration, economic, political, military, on the post-Soviet space would be significantly hindered if Ukraine doesn't join the Russia-led economic, political, and military union. And that was an attempt, actually, if the best-case scenario, to force Ukraine to join that union, the worst-case scenario, to preclude Ukraine from joining European Union or any NATO or any Western-led alliance.
How different is Ukraine culturally from the culture of Russia?
Well, it depends at what region in Ukraine you look. And when you look at the areas closer to Central Europe, to Poland and to Hungary, to Slovakia, what you see there is that culture is quite different. Certainly the predominant language on the streets would be Ukrainian. Significant portion of the population would be also Ukrainian Catholics as opposed to Orthodox. If you go further to the east and particularly look at the Crimea or eastern Ukraine, the situation is different. In Crimea, that was the only region in Ukraine where the majority of the population was not Ukrainian but Russian. And if you look at Donetsk, ethnic Ukrainians are the majority, but in terms of their culture, in terms of language that they're using, in particular language, the Russian would be predominant on the streets of not villages, but on the streets of towns and major cities in the area. That being said, there is no much difference in that sense between Donetsk and, let's see, other regions in Ukraine that are further west, regions closer to Kyiv. Cultural situation is the same, but these regions are strongly in pro-independence, pro-Kievan camp. And one of the reasons for that, one of the explanations for that, is that the Russian Special Operations Forces and the forces that they used to destabilize the situation, they were kind of neutralized in those areas much faster than that happened in eastern Ukraine, in Donbass in particular. Previous president of Ukraine, Mr. Yanukovych, who was ousted as a result of this popular uprising in Kyiv in February of this year, he came from Donbass, and that was his power base. And the position that the people close to Mr. Yanukovych took in March, in April, in May of this year, led eventually to this major military conflict now in eastern part of Ukraine.
Initially, after the uprising, it appeared that some soldiers in the Ukrainian army were reluctant to fire on fellow Ukrainians, even if they were separatists. Has that reluctance been eliminated?
Well, the major difference between Ukraine and Russia is that Russia has been at continuous war since the end of the Soviet Union. So the first Russian troops were sent to Chechnya in November of 1991, so at the time when the Soviet Union, de jure, still existed. Ukraine never fought any war in the last 23 years. There was no case of people shooting one another on political grounds for the last 23 years. So for the first time, we have the first victims of political violence that came in January of this year, and that was that was a game changer. The troops and the police was reluctant to shoot not only at their own people. They were reluctant even to shoot at the invading forces or separatists who were shooting at them in eastern Ukraine for a long, long period of time. So it's only in the last maybe month and a half that Ukrainian armed forces crossed that psychological barrier that was there. So Ukraine had armed forces, but those armed forces psychologically were not prepared to fight any war.
Tell us about your reaction when you learned of the Malaysia Airlines flight being shot down over Ukraine.
Well, the reaction was it was shock. So I checked, I double checked those news. So it was shock. But on a certain level, I was maybe less surprised than many of our listeners are, because I am following those events, and I knew back then that there were two or three airplanes that were shot in the same area of eastern Ukraine within the previous week. So from that point of view, I had a possible hypothesis that turned out to be pretty close to what we know now about the situation, that was the pro-Russian rebels who were shooting the planes without maybe making difference between military planes and the military cargo planes and then Boeings and jets of civil aviation. From that point of view, again, I was able to put that into broader context. But again, till today, it is shocking. What I would like also to say that we learned a lot about situation there in Ukraine now through the coverage of the shutdown of Malaysian airplane. But this is really a window into what is happening in that region for a relatively long period of time. And I hope that what happened there was also a wake-up call for leaders of quite few European powers who are reluctant or continue to be reluctant till today to apply more pressure on Russia and to force Russia to close the border, to stop supplying mercenaries and military equipment. Today there were two Ukrainian military planes that were shot down more or less in the same area.
Do you think that the people on the ground were simply not sophisticated enough to tell the difference between a large commercial airliner and a Ukrainian military jet, or they just didn't care?
Well, it's difficult to say because we don't know at the end who were the crew, who was the person who pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. Either that was a local rebel or mercenary who didn't have much experience in how to do these things, or whether it was a crew of Russian military servicemen who was sent to Ukraine. And depending on who were those people, probably the explanation would be different. Either this is just criminal indifference or this is lack of experience and confusion.
I was interested to hear the language that President Obama used a couple of days ago in his statement, and he said very pointedly that if President Putin says this should stop, it will stop. And that sounded to me to be not only a call for Russia to stop supporting these separatist rebels, but also an appeal perhaps to the ego of Vladimir Putin.
Well, I think that it was both. After all, what we know, we don't know details of the conversations that President Obama and Putin had immediately after the shutdown. But certainly they're in touch on more or less regular basis, and certainly they have some kind of relationship and some kind of personal relationship that doesn't necessarily translate in the official statement. So I wouldn't exclude if President Obama was trying to appeal to Mr. Putin's ego. What I can say that I absolutely agree with Mr. Obama's assessment that it is probably not in power of Mr. Putin to stop that today some of those groups have their own agendas and fighting for things that maybe Mr. Putin would not necessarily approve or agree with. But he certainly is in a position to close the border, to stop the supply of new arms and new mercenaries. Again, it is not confirmed yet, but according to the Ukrainian statements, the two military planes that were shot down today, most likely that the missile came from the Russian side of the border, from the Russian territory. Again, this is something to be further investigated, but this is one more proof that there are major things that Russia can do if it would be interested in stabilizing the situation. Unfortunately, I don't think this is the case.
Serhii Plokhii is my guest. He is director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. You can join our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Serhii Plokhii, director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Serhii, what do we know about how a much younger Vladimir Putin felt at the time that the Soviet Union actually actively broke up in 1991?
What we know is that at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union, Mr. Putin was a foreign policy advisor for democratically elected mayor of Leningrad, that is the city of St. Petersburg today. And during the coup, he allegedly, during the second day of the coup in August of 1991, he allegedly sent the head of the KGB at that time his letter of resignation. I mentioned this episode in the book. There are also critics of this version of events presented by Mr. Putin, saying that it's absolutely impossible that during the coup, the head of the KGB, who was also running the coup, would have time to consider a letter of resignation from a lieutenant colonel coming from St. Petersburg. So the chances are that the letter and resignation from KGB was written already later after the events of the coup were over and it was clear who won and who lost. But irrespective of whether Mr. Putin was telling or not telling truth in his memoirs, what is very clear is that Mr. Putin's position was reflective of the position of many officers in the KGB who didn't link and didn't associate their future anymore with the old Soviet Union. They were against disintegration of the Soviet Union. This is very clear. Mr. Sobchak was Mr. Putin's boss at that time. The mayor of St. Petersburg was against that. We know from, again, another set of memoirs by Putin that he certainly regretted that. He went online, he went public saying that the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. So what we see there is certainly the rejection maybe of communism and the rejection of the old ways of running the country. But the disintegration of the Soviet Union was really taken by Mr. Putin and people around him as a personal defeat. And what we see today, in my opinion, is also an attempt to get back Russia, not the Soviet Union, more or less in the same position as a world power as it used to be during the Cold War.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Paul in Mesquite. Hello, Paul.
Yes. I'd like to ask your author a question. Is he reluctant to use the phrase "push"?
You know, you just broke up when you said use the phrase, Paul. Can you repeat that, please?
Push the button rather than pull the trigger. Is he reluctant to use the phrase invitation to World War III? And in light of the parallels between the beginning of the forces that caused World War II, aren't there tremendous similarities between what's going on now and then?
Regarding World War III, I believe that what we see here today is really very, very serious, that this is the end of the international order, the way how it existed since the Second World War, since the time of Yalta. In the case of Crimea, we have, for the first time since 1939, that a major power, a country, invades other country and then annexes the territory. So we have all sorts of situation of wars, but this invasion without any pretext and seizing territory, this is really something that didn't witness for a long period of time. Whether this is something that can make think about World War III, I hope that we are really very, very far away from something like that. And the reason for that is that what we see is at this point we don't have any direct confrontation between NATO on the one hand and let's say Russia and Russia-led military coalition on the other. Ukraine is not part of NATO, and my hope is that sooner rather than later, the military conflict there will be stopped, and that negotiations will be resumed. So again, I'm more optimistic than pessimistic in terms of the global war. In terms of the situation in which Ukraine is now and is today, again, I want to be optimistic, but I can't. So that's the first part of your question. And the second was you asked me to draw a parallel between events today and events when?
At the beginning of World War II, he said.
At the beginning of World War II. Okay. So thanks. It looks like that I started answering this question by drawing parallel with 1939. So there were these comparisons made between the way how Russia behaves today and how Nazi Germany behaved in 1939. Again, many people consider that to pushing things too far, making the parallels that really don't belong in today's situation. But what I can say that certainly what is in common there between 1939 and 2014 is an attempt of a major power to use the question of language, national minorities, and rights of national minorities to justify basically aggressive foreign policy. I hope that parallel again would end there and would not go any further.
I recognize that free speech and political protests are not rights in Russia, but I wonder if there is evidence of the electorate within Vladimir Putin's Russia, even if it's a small segment of that electorate, objecting, making an outcry to the invasion of Crimea.
Well, the overall, what we see in Russia today is strong support for what Mr. Putin is doing, not so much for Donbas, but very much for the Crimea. And the approval rating of Mr. Putin is at all-time high, potentially. So it's the big question is what he has to do to keep it there. One of the political observers said he had to invade one country per week to keep it at that level. So this is something that is certainly not good news for the world, but also not good eventually for Russia as well. That being said, we have quite prominent figures, cultural figures like singer Andrei Makarevich. We have people who go to public squares in Moscow to show that they don't like what is happening. Recently, Mrs. Prokhorova, who is used to be chairwoman of one of the liberal-minded political parties and political forces in Russia, who led this march in Moscow against annexation of the Crimea, she had now to resign her position because the supporters of the party in the regions didn't share her stand on the Crimea and Russian foreign policy. So we have this general kind of a euphoria, almost patriotic and almost chauvinist type of euphoria, but we also have quite prominent public intellectuals and some of them also political figures who state very clearly that they don't support what is going on now and they don't support Mr. Putin's policy.
Is there evidence of defensive fortifications being made by other former Soviet bloc countries who feel that if this can happen to Ukraine and may in fact escalate, that they might be next?
Well, what is registered certainly is uneasiness on part of leadership of Belarus, for example. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lukashenko, current president of Belarus, who is considered or sometimes labeled the last European dictator, certainly trying to sit at two chairs at the same time. On the one hand, Belarus is certainly in the Russian military and economic and political bloc, but he also tries to keep good relations with the current Ukrainian government. We also know that there was some uneasiness demonstrated by Mr. Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan. So certainly this is something that the leaders of the and political elites of the countries in the neighborhood watch very carefully. And then there are requests for reinforcements on the part of the new members of NATO, Poland, Baltic states, who asked and are receiving more in terms of presence, of American presence on the territory of Poland, for example, a larger commitment, more airplanes to patrol their borders. So the entire region is really very, very uneasy about what is going on in Ukraine today and what that can mean for the future in terms of the future Russian policy in the region.
What, if any, do you think are the most effective actions that could be taken by the international community to try to convince Putin and his cronies to cease and desist their activity in Ukraine?
Well, one thing that is obvious that to change what is happening now in Ukraine and in region in general without some economic sacrifice on the part of European countries, it would be impossible to do that. So one thing that can change Russian behavior is really a set of sanctions that would present a major danger for normal development of Russian economy. For that kind of sanctions to be implemented, what that means is that would hurt also business interests in Europe. And that's the decision that European businesses, that European countries, political leadership, they have to make. So if again aggression will be not punished and aggressor will not be punished, this is an opening of Pandora box and opening a completely different era in international relations.
Are you talking about a boycott of Russian energy exports?
The boycott, I wouldn't go as far. I don't think that this is necessary. But there are thousands of European firms that do business with Russia. France is continuing to supply. It's not warships, but it's the helicopter carriers and military equipment to Russia. Britain does the same. Again, canceling that kind of contracts would mean major consequences for industry. But again, if you continue to work and cooperate, including in military sphere, with with Russia, and do business as usual, the chances are again that it starts with Ukraine, but it will not end there.
Does the international community have time to decide what it's doing, or does it need to act quickly, or else have no influence whatsoever?
Well, nothing is. It's very difficult to have consensus and common line on anything when it comes to the European Union. So it all needs time. And the time really is running out, because if we have the history of this sanctions that were more symbolic for a long period of time
just
than real ones.
A few seconds left. I'm sorry to rush you.
Right, and it doesn't produce. It doesn't work. That kind of policy doesn't work. So something much more substantial has to be done. And again, the sooner the better, because the further conflict continues, the more difficult it would be to stop it. Partly also
Serhii Plokhii's new book
politically for Mr. Putin
It's called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. Serhii, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.